Congress has now received the president's $4.4 trillion spending proposal.
We have a ridiculous budget process, and as a result of that, we end up with ridiculous budgets.
But the big picture writ large is you have to figure out a way to grow your economy faster than you're growing your government.
So yeah, we've got more to do on entitlements, on mandatory spending. We added more Medicare means testing in this particular bill. When you're getting a bipartisan compromise, sometimes there's some spending you have to accept to get what you need in order to do that.
The budget is like a firework that goes off with a big bang and everybody pays attention to it because it's noisy and bright, and it has zero effect on the people who actually make the decisions year in and year out on funding the government.
This is the Robin Hood principle in reverse. It is a budget that takes from the poor and gives to the very wealthy.
The rhetoric is so over the top that I don't think people know what to believe.
There are some crazy people around here.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
A pleasant weekend. Well, investors can breathe a sigh of relief. Stocks coming back strong this week with gains of 4 to 5% in the markets. We've recouped a little over 60% of the losses that we incurred in that correction. Inflation is on the rise with an uptick in CPI, and inflation indicators are heading up and interest rates are rising. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in hour one, Richard Dixon will be joining me from Lowry's Research. You're going to want to hear what he has to say, especially about that correction, as I asked him, were any of his indicators telling or alerting to him to this downdraft we just went through, and what does it look like ahead? Are we headed for trouble or more good times and higher highs coming to this market? He'll be joining me in hour one. Keith Barron will be here on gold as we take a look at this gold market. Gold is on the march, rising along with other commodities, and we could be heading towards peak gold as production declines around the globe with our major gold-producing companies. How are those gold reserves going to be replaced? Keith will tell you what he thinks is going to happen next. And of course, Ryan Poplava out this week. I'll be sitting in and talking about what were the big movers this week in the market. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. Hey, amusement parks don't get this good. Wow, what a precipitous drop of 3,000 points that we went through last week. But good news, we've recouped two-thirds of those losses, and that seems to be happening with the other major indexes as well. But the question is still there, isn't it, in the back of your mind? What just really happened? Was this just a healthy correction, and will we see more of the bull market we've seen since the crash in 2008? Or was last week's storm the beginning of something more ominous and the beginning of the end of the bull market? And two questions, how do you function if it is an end game for the bull market? And then how do you predict when it's going to roll into a bear market and a recession? That is the summary of what we're going to discuss today. Of course, the implications for your investments on the big picture right here on the... And we go down to Wall Street to see what went on this week. Ryan Poplava is out this week. Jim Poplava sitting in for him. You're in the privileged chair, Jim, there. See, that's Ryan's place over there.
Or the electric chair.
Yeah, and remember to leave a quarter on the seat. That's rent. Boy, what a difference a week makes. Look at that. Last week at this time, we were sort of reeling 10% losses from the major highs that we'd hit. Now things are looking a little chippier. Okay, we did have a rebound this week, and so I guess the question is, as we start out, what was actually driving the rebound? Is it simply a bounce back, or is there really something bigger behind it?
Well, John, we've been talking on the weekend program, and a lot of our guests here on the program talking about it as well, is the fundamentals are still in place. The economy, economic growth is picking up. We've got a lot of stimulus coming into the market. Earnings, especially now with this tax cut, are going to be stronger because you cut tax rates from 35 to 21, you're going to see higher earnings because corporations are going to make more money. So simply, fundamentals are looking good for both the economy and earnings. And we got more signs of this, too, because as we talked about, one of the big things that was going to kick in this year was this massive tax stimulus that was being put in place beginning this year. If you're an employee, you probably saw a bump in your paycheck starting this month as withholding by employers is adjusted to reflect the new tax law. But we also got more signs of stimulus on Monday. In fact, one of the big things moving the markets on Monday today is the Trump administration released its infrastructure spending plans for 2019 and also its budget proposal. Now, the plan calls for $200 billion of federal spending is seed money to be matched by state and private spending for a total stimulus, John, over the next 10 years, a $1.5 trillion over the next decade. In addition to that, the government's fiscal year ends in September, so they're not on a calendar year. They also submitted their budget for 2019. That calls for $4.4 trillion of spending. That's an increase over the previous year by $300 billion. So it's not just that we have a tax law that's kicking in with stimulus by lowering taxes for individuals and corporations. We also have government spending that's kicking in. $300 billion is a lot of money, and that's about $150 billion a year. Then on top of that, they're calling for these big infrastructure spending bills. So it just seems like the economy keeps getting a greater lift as more and more stimulus keeps being applied. You know, the Republicans ran on a couple things. Getting rid of Obamacare, which has not happened. Lowering taxes, which has happened, kicks in this year. And the third is massive infrastructure spending, which is badly needed in this country. So they're moving on to infrastructure spending, which should be a little bit easier to get through because you have a lot of governors in the states that need to see a lot of this money be spent, whether it's repairing bridges, roads, canals, waterways, you name it. The country's infrastructure has been given a D minus by the civil engineers. And so there's money that needs to be spent. I don't know what it's like where you're at, John, but in California, you can just see the decay in infrastructure throughout the state and wherever you go. Potholes. Our bridge here in San Diego is listed as a dangerous bridge. Airports. I mean, you name it. Money needs to be spent.
Which, of course, raises the question, with all of this stimulus being applied, what does this mean for inflation and interest rates?
Well, John, I don't care wherever you're looking. Inflation is picking up, and it is also moving interest rates higher. We'll get to a couple reports, but they're all confirming that inflation is indeed ticking up. Usually when you see a one-month report and CPI or PPI, you sort of dismiss it. What you're looking for is a pattern of consistency of rising inflation, not just 1 month, but several months. And things got a little dicey on Wednesday. Consumer prices were reported. They jumped higher than expected, up 0.5% in the month of January. Year over year, they were up 2.1%. And of course, initially when that was reported, the markets headed south. But by the end of the day, the indexes were able to recover. But what we did see on that day, we saw 10-year Treasury notes cross the 2.9% level. They hit 2.926 that day. They pulled back just a little bit. But, you know, one of the things that we have mentioned, and we'll talk about it in the big picture, is during this market sell-off that we saw, typically you see this run to safety in Treasuries. That did not happen this time around. Interest rates remain stubbornly high, and it looks like they are going to be heading higher. So the market recovered by the end of the day, but the dollar continues to fall against major currencies like the euro and the yen. That's raising some questions here. And we'll talk more about rising inflation in today's big picture. But the good news here continues with better than expected earnings. We're seeing this all across the board with many companies. On Thursday, Cisco reported earnings that beat estimates. They also not only beat their estimates, but they also said going forward, they raised their estimates. And nothing more that stock investors like to hear is a company that comes in, beats their earnings, and then raises earnings going forward. So you're not just looking at a quarterly fluke. Cisco, by the way, is bringing back, I think next to Apple, they're bringing back close to $40 billion of money from overseas. They announced on Wednesday they are increasing their stock buyback by another $25 billion. So they will now have in place $31 billion. Cisco's stock popped 5% on that news, hitting its highest level in nearly 20 years. It's amazing to see a lot of those companies during the internet phase that led the markets, the Microsofts, the Ciscos. Now, Microsoft is at all-time record highs, and Cisco is moving in that same direction.
Also, Jim, wasn't it this week? I mean, they kept announcing one good economic report after another. It seems like the business channels are the only ones discussing this. The mainline channels are all absorbed with the shooting in Florida.
On Thursday, there was just a bevy of economic reports. We had producer prices, which also rose. So what do we have here? We have rising CPI, rising PPI, or producer prices. They rose 0.4%. Producer prices are up 2.7% year over year. So it's confirming the other trends that we're seeing, inflation. We got industrial production for the month of January. That was down about 0.1%. Capacity utilization ticked down to 77.5 from 77.7. The downturn was driven mainly by mining output. We also got initial jobless claims that came in around 230,000, a tad higher than what was anticipated, but certainly showing a tightening labor market. And, you know, the key takeaway here is these initial claims are showing increasingly a tight labor market, which is something that concerns the Fed. You would think the Fed would like wages to rise. They really don't. The other thing is we had the Empire survey come out on Thursday. That declined to 13.1. So that was a bit of a surprise. But also the Philly Fed survey, and this is a big one. It looks at all the states. That increased to 25.8. The consensus was 22. So that was a big surprise on the earnings front. Building permits and housing starts also came in. And here's another one. Once again, confirming this trend we're starting to see to rising inflation levels, we saw import-export prices rise. They're up over 3.6% year over year. So we have rising PPI, producer prices. We have rising CPI. We have rising import prices. The other thing in many of these surveys, whether it was the Fed survey, it shows that the prices paid component is starting to rise. So everything is really looking good on the economic front. But along with that is rising inflation. And we'll have more to say about that when we get to the big picture, because it's one reason why you're seeing interest rates begin to rise as we approach that 3% level. That's going to be a key threshold. Do we stabilize at 3% or do we actually head higher? And as many of the technicians and experts we've had here on the program talk about, you start getting up to the 3.5% level or marching to 4%, this economy could be in trouble.
So for the week, I guess overall, we would say that things did look pretty good.
Yeah, we're back into positive territory for the major indexes. The Dow was up 4.25% for the week. It is now in positive territory, up 2% for the year. You have the S&P 500, that was up 4.3%. It's up over 2%. You also had the NASDAQ composite up over 5%, showing that strong leadership trend with technology stocks. It is now up close to 5% for the year. We also got a slew of economic reports on Friday, all of them confirming the trend that we have seen since the beginning of the year, something that's really standing out. Earnings are increasing and companies are raising estimates. That should continue for the balance of this year. And also the economic reports are confirming that things are basically heating up. And then, of course, the confirmation that we're starting to see across the board in inflation with higher interest rates.
And as we wrap out on the market wrap, anything else we want to watch for the weeks ahead, Jim?
Really, we're just finishing out the earnings season, so I would expect to see that trend continue with more companies beating estimates and raising those estimates. But one of the things that was mentioned with the stimulus, would companies spend? Cisco is going to buy back stock. I think there's going to be some hesitation to go all out and spend money because the Fed is raising interest rates, and companies know what happens. When the Fed is in a rate-raising cycle, they know they raise them to the point you're in a recession. And we'll talk more about that in the big picture.
All right, Jim Poplava, thanks for sitting in for Ryan Poplava, who should be back next week. And the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
Should you buy and hold at a market top? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things you love most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
If we have a substantial decline, I mean, Goldman Sachs has got some estimates, and they say that last year the growth in stocks, I think, was 19% for the year, pushed up GDP growth by 0.6%, and if stock went down 20%, it would take 1.6% off of GDP. Well, when you're growing about 2.5%, you take off 1.6%. Hey, that's a chunk. So you could have that effect. And then, as they say, and I'm not forecasting this. I mean, I sure don't know what stocks are going to do. You know, is this just a temporary sell-off? All is forgiven. It's all over. Or is there a lot more to go? We'll see. But you could get all these other effects in this concern about confidence, worried about inflation, worrying about the Fed, worrying about the deficit, worried about protectionism, worried about inflation, all these things. I think there are more worries than reality, but cumulatively, you could have enough effects to touch off a recession. Now, as I say, that would be, as far as I know, the first time you'd had that death by a thousand cuts. Historically, it's either been the Fed jacking up rates till they kill the economy, or some very clear excess that simply fell apart.
Well, investors can breathe a sigh of relief. After dropping precipitously over the previous couple of weeks, stocks are on the rise again. Will this continue, or is this just a relief rally? Joining us on the program from Lowry's Research is Richard Dixon. Richard, I want to go to something that you guys do at your organization. You have some proprietary indicators that you use, buying pressure and selling pressure. Was there anything in those gauges prior to this 10% correction that would have maybe alerted you that something like that was coming?
Well, the buying power and selling pressure indexes are really intermediate to longer term measures of the forces of supply and demand. So we use them principally as a means of gauging the strength of the market's primary trend, the bull market, in other words. And I can say that at the time of the January 26th high in the S&P 500, our selling pressure index was 1 point above its low for the entire bull market, and buying power was at a new rally high. Both of them were in solid long-term trends. Buying power was in an uptrend dating to the November 2016 market low. Selling pressure was in a downtrend dating from also November 2016. So, you know, as far as the dominant trends of supply and demand were concerned, they still suggested a very healthy bull market. As a matter of fact, that combination of uptrending buying power and downtrending selling pressure is the strongest pattern that we have in a bull market. And historically, it's been more indicative of the early stages of a bull market rather than the latter stages. So a little bit surprising to see in a market that's about to celebrate, but it's 9th anniversary.
You know, this maybe gets back to the point that a lot of this was maybe technical, where you had this unwinding of these volatility funds that were leveraged. Because, you know, if you take a look at the VIX going back to the election in 2016, the VIX had gotten to an all-time record low. There were a lot of big leverage bets that it would stay in that way. And all of a sudden there was an attack on it and the whole thing blew up within a week. So do you think maybe that had to count more for what you saw take place in the market here during that corrective phase?
I think it definitely contributed to the extent and probably the speed of the decline in the market. What was fascinating about this market, you mentioned how low the VIX had been, the very low volatility. An analogy we have been making here was with the 1995 market, which also had very, very low volatility. No corrections, 3% or greater from December 1994 until December 1995, which is very similar to what we had, because from November 2016 low, really right up until January, this January high, there had been no corrections of 3%. I think the largest percent pullback was about 2.9% in the S&P, which I believe was back in July, August last year. So, you know, there was a comparison there. Also, we follow 90% days, 90% up days, 90% down days. And there had been none. The last 90% day was an up day right after the November 2016 low. So there are certain parallels between those two. And at the time of the January 26th high, I was looking at it, and it was fairly obvious that we had had an acceleration in the uptrend. Now, people were talking about a parabolic rise from January 2nd right through the 26th. So I said, okay, well, there are a couple things here. One is this acceleration. So I looked at, this was an 18-day period, so I looked at other periods where we had similar 18-day accelerations. Virtually all of them came off market bottoms, which is really no surprise. That's where the market can move up the fastest. So I really looked to see where did it happen in latter stages of a rally. Well, guess what? It happened in the latter stages of the rally in 1995. Actually, it was to the March high in 1996, which was the first significant pullback you had in that rally, with 4.4% drop in the S&P. The second thing I looked at was, people were talking about how extended this rally is. And the device that's fairly commonly used is how far an index, in this case the S&P, is above its 50-day moving average. So I said, okay, let's measure that right now. And it was at 6.32% above the 50-day moving average as of the January 26th high. So going along with the analogy with 1995 rally, I looked to see where it was in March of 1996, just before it started its pullback. It was 6.28% above its 50-day moving average, virtually the same. So, you know, at that point, we said here that, look, you know, there are no guarantees in the market, but whereas extended, this has been a very similar rally to what we had in 95. Here we are, as extended as we were, in an acceleration that's basically the same as we were in 1990, in this case, 96. Risk's probably pretty high to see a pullback. Did we say we're going to see a 10% pullback in a week? No. But that, on a short-term basis, seemed to indicate that the risk of a pullback there was pretty high.
You know, what really struck me, too, about this latest correction of 10%. Normally, Richard, we've seen throughout this bull market, anytime we'd have a major corrective phase, as we just went through, you would see a switch from the risk-on trade to the risk-off. Things like consumer staples, utilities, healthcare, a rally in treasuries. None of that took place in this last correction. Yields remain stubbornly high, and staples, you know, they got hit pretty hard along with utilities and healthcare.
Yeah. Well, you know, there really has been a change in the character of the market. Really, you can date back to 2016 and beginning of 2017, where you really saw a shift in emphasis from value stocks to growth stocks. And this may, in part, have been a result of expectations that, you know, we had the so-called TINA market for years, where you had very, very low interest rates. And, you know, there is no alternative if you want to get a higher yield to buy equities. And the highest yields typically are in value stocks, consumer staples, and utilities. But starting at that November low, you did see a shift towards growth stocks, possibly on anticipation, and I'm not trying to make a political statement here at all, but possibly anticipation that you're going to see a market that is, let's call it maybe more traditional in the sense that it's based more now on expectations of rising earnings rather than low interest rates. And that may be the motivating force behind the emphasis that we have had on cyclical stocks, on growth stocks throughout the rally last year, and the fact that you continue to see some strength in both those areas, even during this pullback that we've had. And to a degree, there's been, utilities have had a bit of a bounce out of this. Staples have had a bit of a bounce. Perhaps it's sort of an oversold rebound. But we think that the strength is still going to be in the growth areas, the cyclical areas of the market.
Now, in addition to following buying and selling pressure on the major market indexes, you also do that on sectors. And are you seeing the same strength in the leadership? For example, if you look at the technology sector, it has bounced back and is very, very strong. If you want to look at, you know, something like the ETF XLK. So are you seeing the same strength in those patterns of leadership that existed before the correction?
Yeah, the two areas right now that seem to have the greatest strength, consumer cyclicals continues to stand out as sort of the star. And Infotech, I think most of your listeners know, that had kind of a rough patch at the end of 2017 and, you know, into January. But it has come back. And particularly, you know, you have stocks like Cisco leading the telecommunications area higher. You're seeing somewhat of a rebound in some of the semiconductor areas, software in particular. So those would be the two areas right now which seem to be offering the greatest promise of leadership in the weeks ahead.
What we're seeing is we're seeing a nice uptrend in commodities. We're seeing it in oil. We're seeing it in copper. And the Bloomberg Commodity Index is breaking out. Are you seeing any follow through on the stock side? Like, for example, materials, aluminum stocks. I know the energy stocks got whacked pretty hard in this last downturn, but are you seeing follow through in those areas?
You're seeing sort of selective follow through in the basic materials area. Some of the non-ferrous metals. Gold obviously has had a nice jump here over the last week or so. You know, the weaker dollar obviously comes into play. It's been especially weak against the Japanese yen. Maybe we'll start to see the carry trade come back. I don't know. But we don't really see any signs of a major strengthening in the dollar. And so that would suggest that you could very easily continue to see strength in the commodity space.
So, Richard, you know, let's just, for example, erase the correction that just took place. From your buying and selling pressure, the sectors that are leading the market, does it look pretty much the same as it did on January 26 in terms of the leadership, what's happening in the market and the sectors?
Yeah. You know, as you alluded to earlier, the extent of this pullback may have been magnified by special factors. You know, you mentioned the VIX, the volatility trade, and the fact so many of these XIV is obviously the poster child for what can happen shorting VIX in a market like this. Also, you have the passive investing and the fact that your mega cap stocks actually were amongst the hardest hit. You know, we think small cap, mid cap would get hit pretty hard, but mega caps are actually the hardest hit here. So there are some technical factors which tend to magnify the extent of this pullback. That's speculation, obviously, but it seems that we didn't seem to be really set up for this kind of violent move lower. You know, 2,000 point moves in the Dow over a space of a few days. It just seemed a little more violent than what you would anticipate. So really, to answer your question, no, we've not seen any changes whatsoever. The primary uptrend is intact, and we fully expect to see new highs for the S&P, the Dow Jones, NASDAQ, in the weeks ahead.
So as you look at this, I want to turn to another market right now, and that is the Treasury market, because as I mentioned, typically when you have these corrective phases, you see this rotation into the safety trade, you know, as I mentioned, staples, utilities, healthcare, but you also see a movement into Treasuries. That did not happen. In fact, on this Friday, we're still close to 2.9%. Let's talk about interest rates for a moment and what you see there.
We see no reason to argue with people expecting to see a series of interest rate hikes by the Federal Reserve later this year, possibly in the next year, probably in the next year, and a further rise in long-term rates. I guess, you know, we're not quite as concerned about long-term rates if they are accompanying the continued growth in the economy. If you're talking about 3%, 3% plus growth in the economy, that's not necessarily going to really be short-circuited by higher rates. At some point, obviously, that does come into play, but nobody really knows where that is. And, you know, that's where we think that these forces of supply and demand that are driving the market higher are going to give us some advance warning even before it becomes evident that the higher rates are now starting to act as a brake on the economy. So to really look at the treasuries and say, well, you know, gee, they're awfully high and, you know, they could really, you know, chalk off this rally, and to say, well, you know, where's the evidence in terms of, again, falling back on the forces of supply and demand? As long as demand is outstripping supply, prices really only have one way to go, and that's up. And that's where we are.
You know, one thing that has been absent in this bull market has been driven in many ways by central banks and corporate buybacks. We just had a lot of major buybacks announced by several companies. Richard, we haven't really seen the full participation of individual investors. A lot of that money by investors after the financial crisis went into bond funds. You just have to wonder, as rates head up and as bond funds lose their value, if you see that rotation by the public out of bond funds into stock funds that could give us that kind of melt-up rally you usually see towards the end of bull markets.
It's entirely possible. I really have no idea the degree to which individual have or have not been participating. I don't think you can really look at equity funds, particularly managed equity funds. Monies have been flowing out of them on a regular basis for the last few years. That money obviously has been going either into the index products or as ETFs. You know, so I don't know how much money is on the sidelines. And we can probably argue about that and what credit balances are and margin accounts, how high margin accounts are. You know, again, we would go back to just the basics in terms of supply and demand. And you know, whether it's institutional investors driving it higher, whether it's individual investors driving it higher, you know, we know that individuals tend to become most heavily involved in the latter stages of a bull market. Okay. Is that going to become evident? Well, you saw it to a small degree with some of these figures in the AAII sentiment survey from about, I guess, about a month ago, when you had extremely high levels of bullishness and low levels of bearishness. And you know, people say, yep, see, there you go. You got the January high in the market. Okay. Is that going to be a motivating factor at the latter stages? Well, fine, if it is. But you know, again, go back to looking at what's the internal condition of the market. And so whether the individuals are there or not, if the internal on the market start to show real signs of deterioration, and he's giving us the traditional signs of an approaching market top, that's what we're going to call.
Your organization has been doing this for literally 70, 80 years. As you follow these patterns, if you were looking forward, I guess, if there was trouble that was giving you a clue that could possibly erupt in the markets, where this last one we just went through was sort of very quick, I call it fast and furious, sort of out of the blue. What factors would you be looking at to tell you that things aren't looking good and possible trouble is ahead?
Well, there are, as they say, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And there are certain factors which seem to repeat themselves time and time again. And you know, we have been looking at market tops going back to 1929, and there are characteristics that markets share. Not exactly the same, but they are very similar. One of them being, you start to see a deterioration in market breadth as manifested by the advanced decline line. So we use what we call our operating companies only advanced decline line, which is simply common stocks. So it's taking out the effect that you might have, for instance, on higher yields, on things like utility stocks or non-common stock issues such as preferred stocks, closed-end bond funds, things like that, that trade on the New York Stock Exchange are included in their statistics, particularly in things like new highs, new lows, and advanced decline line. So we look at these as what we call our OCO, advanced decline line. Well, that starts to diverge, won't confirm the highs in the price indexes that we found on average about 4 to 6 months before the final market top. Then we go back to one of the first things you mentioned, our buying power and selling pressure indexes. You start to see selling pressure increase. And then you know, at the latter stages, buying power and selling pressure are both going up. People are still buying, but you're seeing an increased amount of profit taking. Once that buying power starts to turn down, now the people are finding relatively few stocks at values worth buying, so demand is really starting to shrink. Supply is starting to go up. You get a combination with the advanced decline lines, and you can say, okay, we're now looking for a market top. And then generally we'll be using our intermediate trend buying and selling controls to give us a more precise signal as to you know, when we are now very, very close to the market top. We're not going to try to pinpoint the top. For instance, 2007, we had our sell signal in July, and the market topped in October, and but continued to show signs of deterioration even as it was rallying to that October high. So, you know, our investors were forewarned, you know, don't be misled by this rally. We had a nice sell signal in 2000 that also gave us an indication that that basically sideways to even a little bit up market in September of 2000 was the last gasp, so to speak. So, you know, there are certain things, new highs, new lows, a series of lower peak readings and new highs can be a very good indication, a very early indication of an approaching market top. And these things have happened time and time and time again at market highs. So these are things that we look for, and they were very conspicuous by their absence at this January 26th high in the S&P.
So from your perch, as you take a look at the market, as we resume this trend, I think we've recouped a little over 60% of those losses. Everything looks pretty much the same as before the correction, and so it seems like all clear ahead.
Mm-hmm. As far as the market's primary trend is concerned, that's absolutely true.
Well, listen, Richard, as we close, I know you follow a lot of markets and you also have a new service. You're following international markets as well. If our listeners would like to find out more about your service, and I just want to mention you're probably one of the oldest technical services in the country out there.
The oldest.
You've been doing it for quite some time. How can they do that?
The easiest thing to do is just go online and look up Lowry On Demand. It's Lowry On Demand, all is one word. And it'll pop up with our Lowry Research and with our website. And, you know, people are welcome to apply for a free trial.
Well, Richard, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. We appreciate you coming on. Have yourself a great weekend.
That's right. Remember, don't come in on Monday.
That's right. We got a holiday. All right. Take care, my friend. Interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
In the State of the Union speech, President Trump called for more vocational training. We need more skilled workers in this country. Join me on the program is Cameron Sorsby from Praxis, a business that does exactly that. Cameron, why don't we start out for our listeners and tell our listeners what Praxis is, what you're doing that makes you guys stand out and a little different than, let's say, the standard paradigm. You go to high school, you graduate, you go to college, and you hope to get a job when you graduate.
Sure. So Praxis is a one-year apprenticeship program, and we're combining both kind of education experience as well as starting your professional career with a six-month apprenticeship where you're gaining pretty intensive work experience. And how Praxis stands out among education options as well as initial career paths people choose is that we are blending together education and work. Usually those two things are isolated, how people view them. and they kind of see school and education as these multiple steps of preparation until you get to the point where you need to be starting your career. And what Praxis does is pretty much say the best way to learn how to create value in the professional world is through work itself. And you should be viewing work as an education constantly for yourself, and it never really ends. And through the one-year program, we're kind of setting up people with the most ideal experience to get started and helping them build the mindset so they can kind of develop those types of habits themselves long-term.
Well, one of the aspects of the recent sell-off is just about every asset class went down, including gold, treasuries, and just about everything that was considered safe. But the only thing that held up is if you were in cash. But what about gold in times of turmoil like this? Joining us on the program is Keith Barron. He's chairman and CEO of Urania Resources. Keith, one of the things that really struck me about the sell-off that we had is usually in the past when we had corrections, people would gravitate out of the what I call the risk-on trade. They would go into risk-off. Treasuries would rally. You would see things like consumer staples, healthcare and utilities, and even gold. That didn't happen this time. Gold fell just as well as other asset classes. So let's talk about gold, where it stands right now. It looks like we had a nice big jump on Thursday in the price of gold. From your perch, where do you see gold prices here?
Well, I don't think gold actually slipped as much as broad market equities, certainly percentage-wise, nowhere near what the Dow did. But gold actually behaved like a real champ. It did exactly what it's supposed to do. And, you know, people have asked me over the last week, they said, so why didn't people pile into gold and the gold price suddenly spike up as a safe haven? Well, just remember that gold is the most liquid thing out there, and you can always turn it into cash. So people who had margin calls on their equities ran to the piggy bank and raided their gold bullion or their gold coins or whatever, and sold them to protect their positions in the Dow 50, the Dow 30, whatever. And this is what happened. So, you know, we saw this kind of behavior in 2009 during the big crisis. So eventually gold does come back, and we've seen it come back really with a vengeance in the last week. One day it went up as much as $24. The media said that it was due to the numbers that came out, consumer inflation climbing up. But I think that people are just starting to realize, and maybe feeling a little bit threatened, that, hey, if we have a real nasty downturn like we had 10 years ago, then we got to protect ourselves with safe havens, either in gold or accumulate some cash. So I think that's largely what the reason for the gold move in the last couple of days. Longer term, it's funny, you know, I've been around this business for a long, long time. I've been following the gold business since I was 17 years old, and I've seen lots and lots of cycles. And for most of my life, people have been saying that when inflation starts to climb, you should look very carefully at gold as a safe haven. I think as we move further away from the great hyperinflations in the West, you know, in places like Hungary and Germany in 1923, people are forgetful really what damage inflation can do. I've spent a good chunk of my life in South America, and I've seen the Argentine currency go to zero. I've seen the Brazilian Cruzeiro and then the Cruzado get decimated. I've seen the peso, the Mexican peso, really get slammed as well. So, you know, it's no big news to people in Latin America, but people in the Western Europe and in North America tend to have a short memory on these kinds of things. Last year, I remember commentators on CNBC talking about, if interest rates go up, there's going to be a movement out of gold, because treasuries and bonds are going to be more attractive, you know, if you're looking to earn interest. But the reality is that when inflation really starts to pick up steam, then it pares away the value of your paper currency. And certainly that's not where you want to be. So I've always advocated that people have at least some position in precious metals, both gold and silver. And if Donald Trump actually goes ahead with his very, very inflationary program of spending huge amounts of money on infrastructure, it will be very inflationary and very bad for the dollar.
Well, we're certainly seeing the dollar go down, and you know, you can put it on a chart. They travel in opposite directions. The dollar peaked back in 2016, and it's been going down ever since. And of course, we've seen gold go up. And as you just mentioned, interest rates have risen. We got up to 2.9% this week on the 10-year Treasury, and yet gold has been rising since that period of time. And when it comes to inflation, Keith, we're getting more news. It's starting to pick up, whether it's producer prices this week or consumer prices. They're certainly not anything that we would call hyperinflationary, but they are starting to rise, which is a favorable environment. I want to talk about something else that is in the gold world. Is we've seen this in energy. It takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of time to bring a gold mine in production, especially today with all the environmental red tape. And sometimes a lot of governments are not friendly to mining. Let's talk about the industry itself, because they're producing gold, the major producers, whether it's Barrick, whether it's Newmont, I don't care where you're looking, they're not increasing their production. It's been declining. Do you see that reversing itself? And if you are a major like Newmont or Barrick or whatever big mining company that's out there, how do you replace your gold reserves? Because I haven't heard of any major discoveries, at least not making it into the news, that are sizable.
Well, there haven't been any sizable discoveries for quite a few years now. Yes, the majors are certainly chewing through their reserves, and this is a very, very big problem for the industry at large. It's many, many years ago now that most major companies jettison their exploration people. Whenever there's a downturn in the industry, they're always the first ones that are shown the door and given their pink slips. It's a shame, you know. The majors are very short-sighted in this regard. And they think, well, we can buoy up our reserves through mergers and acquisitions. Now it's in a situation where really they don't have a choice. If they're going to survive, then they have to gobble up the mid-tier producers and junior companies that have robust discoveries. So this has been a sea change in the industry over really the last two decades. I've seen it tremendous changes in my career, and I think this is what's going to happen going forward. They're just going to have to slice the pie more and more different ways. But the aggregates of gold out there that is extractable out of the ground is dropping precipitously. There's been a number of studies done over the last couple of years that say that if we haven't already reached peak gold, we're going to reach it next year. And then after that, the amount of gold that is produced worldwide is going to drop. And that's not because people haven't been looking for it. People have been scouring the world for it. It's just that it's getting harder and more expensive to find. And, you know, you're bang on when you say that some countries are not favorable to the mining industry. We just saw today in Mongolia, people with a very major copper producer there being ordered by the Mongolian government to build a power plant within 4 years. Well, that's nonsense, really. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to accomplish that. And these are the sorts of things that sometimes get done without any real forethought. They're politically motivated. Also, we've got a situation where if you make a major discovery in the U.S., it's certainly going to attract a number of lawsuits from NGOs, and the NGOs are being clever these days. They're not necessarily going after the mining companies. They're going after the people like the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service and going after them for issuing the permits. they're a lot softer target. So it's just getting harder and harder to work in this business because huge tracts of land, swaths of land, have been declared off limits. Either they've been turned into national parks, and certainly they are completely off limits, or, you know, they're in states like California where, you know, you have a very, very low probability of ever getting a project through the goalpost.
You know, this is interesting because you talk about the role of government here, which is impeding exploration and finding more reserves. Sometimes, Keith, that can be changed. President Trump has opened up ANWR, which was, you know, prohibited from drilling for oil for almost three decades. He's sanctioned the Keystone Pipeline. So could this be possibly reversed? And if it is, would that open up a greater possibility for, let's say, gold exploration and replacing these reserves? Because right now, as you mentioned, there hasn't been any major gold discoveries. The majors aren't looking for it. They got rid of their exploration department. And so the only thing left is to buy somebody else. But once again, when you buy somebody else, you aren't adding to an increase in gold production. You're just simply slicing up the pie in your favor.
Yeah, it's going from one pocket into the other pocket. Donald Trump is much more favorable towards the mining business as a whole, but a lot of the agencies that grant the permits are not federal, they're state. And some of the states, as we know, are openly hostile to what Donald Trump is trying to propose and get through Congress and the Senate. So it's a battle. It's always been a battle, and it will continue to be a battle. But, you know, the gold business in the state of Nevada makes a tremendous amount of money. I think I have seen the figures, but not recently. It rivals gambling, if it's not even more than gambling. It's a huge amount of money for the state, and it employs a huge number of people. Very, very important. So, you know, some of these states, like the state of Montana, has had a ban on using cyanide in the production of gold. I think it's been in place now since 1993 or 1994. Newmont has got a deposit there that's over 10 million ounces of gold. I'm sure that the state could use the revenue. I know that some of the property is on a school section, and certainly education could use the money. But, you know, it's politically a hot potato. And it's a very difficult thing to roll back that legislation. So, you know, I myself, I don't do any exploration in the U.S. now or in Canada. I work in frontier countries. And as you're aware, I'm doing a lot of work in Ecuador right now in a place that doesn't have much infrastructure, but it's also virgin ground. And there aren't many real frontier areas left on this planet. Maybe we're going to have to go to Mars.
Keith, let me ask you this. A number of years ago, when it came to oil production, especially as we headed into 2008, when the price of oil got up to $150 a barrel, there was a lot of talk, and you know, I was a believer back then, that we had reached peak oil, and it turned out that was not the case. We had horizontal drilling, fracking, and shale oil. In this year, the U.S. is exceeding 10 million barrels a day of production, something we haven't done since 1970. Is there anything that you're aware of, since you're in exploration, in the mining business, technology-wise, that could help miners get in and extract more gold from the ground, find more gold? Is there anything happening technologically that it could change this equation, just as fracking, horizontal drilling changed, and shale changed the oil business?
Well, fracking has certainly been an incredible innovation. Most people don't realize that, though it was it's been around since the 1940s, the late 1940s. But it's certainly picked up steam, and it's a standard tool now. And there's lots of companies going after shale basins where it didn't make any sense in the past. Is there a magic bullet like this for gold? Actually, no. We don't really have any special techniques to go into frontier areas and find more gold or to find gold at depth. I think that the only really real innovation perhaps that we're experiencing now, and it's not adding to the sum total of gold in a huge way, but people are able to handle very, very large data sets. Some of this is done through crowdsourcing, and there's been a number of companies in Canada that over the last 10 years have really opened their data rooms to anyone, any comers, and offered prizes to companies that and individuals who can figure out where to drill and where to get the biggest bang in their buck. So they're looking at data sets, maybe mines that have been in production from, say, 1910, 1920, almost to the present day. So you're looking at many, many decades of data. So this is all usually recorded on paper or on linen and stored in vaults where the major mines are working, and usually covered in thick layers of dust and forgotten. So these things are getting hauled out, they're getting digitized, and the data sets are being put together, and you can actually now, using virtual reality, look at mine plans in three dimension using special goggles, and it's a real amazing experience when you do this. So you can actually see where the areas that are unmined are still there. So this is really a cleanup operation to get the very last number of ounces from these old mines, and it's giving them a few more years on life, but it's not any earth-shattering stuff. So it's not adding really, really meaningful ounces. So, you know, short of finding another, well, as I said, you know, maybe we'll go to Mars, but you really have to find another planet to go and look at, to explore. Probably we know that there was water running on the surface of Mars. There's probably some placer alluvial gold concentrations there. But nobody's going to get to exploit them in our lifetimes. No, so the short answer to your question is that there is no magic bullet to find more gold, and it's just going to get harder and more expensive. Gold mines today are mining stuff. I think the average for the industry is 0.79 grams per ton of gold in the rock, and this is very, very low. This is a historic low. And I can remember when I started my career back in the early 80s, that sort of stuff was throwaway, because really we didn't have the technology to extract gold that was at such low levels. Now, remember, you can take every tiny, tiny bit of gold out of the rock. There's always some that's left behind. So if you're mining stuff that's 0.79 grams per ton, you don't have a lot of wiggle room. Maybe you're going to leave 0.2 or 0.3 grams in the tailings, and the rest you can extract. So we're really at the real limit now of what the industry can do.
Well, it sounds to me like in the future, a lot of these companies are going to have to go on the acquisition trail. But once again, that's not going to add to the aggregate. Keith, as we close here, if our listeners would like to find out more about your company, Aurania, and what you're doing on the exploration front, how can they do so, please?
Well, they can have a look at our website, aurania.com. It's spelled A-U-R-A-N-I-A. We're working in Ecuador. We have a series of entertaining videos that we shoot every so often and put on the web and on YouTube. And I invite any of your listeners to give it a glance.
Well, after the wild roller coaster ride we had last week, something to put a lot of amusement parks to shame, investors can breathe a sigh of relief. You know, we went down 3,000 points, but we've regained about two-thirds of those losses with similar realities in other major indexes. The big question is, however, what just happened? Was this simply a correction which was long overdue, or is it the beginning of the end of a bull market and the rollover into a bear market? And if so, what are the indicators, and how do you need to behave investorally in such an environment? That is the subject of the big picture coming up next as the Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.